Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And greetings on this Monday. What is it? What day of the week? I've lost my calendar. Good heavens. Oh, it's the 9th of June. There we go. Greetings. Over the weekend. But just by the way, coming up today, in our second hour, we're going to be talking about profits over humanity, which is more important. And in our third hour, Frank Gaffney, the founder and president of the Center for Security Policy and one of the original signatories to the Project for the New American Century, one of the original bomb Iraq guys, is going to be with us. Later on in the program tomorrow, we're going to open the show with John Bolton. David Sirota will be with us. Dr. Leslie Lyon is going to be with us. Terry Jeffrey of CNS News is going to drop by on Wednesday as we look at the issues of the day through the lens of conservatives and liberals. Ralph Reed will be with us on Thursday, and Libertarian Bob Barr as well. And then, of course, on Friday, Senator Bernie Sanders, the arguably most progressive member of the entire Congress, all of Congress, is going to be with us and answering for a full hour your questions, as he has on this program every Friday for 5 years. So taking your questions and your calls. Greetings, by the way, to 91.2 to the mic in Madison, Wisconsin. I dropped by the morning show this morning. It was just absolutely great. Hope to do it more frequently, and just a tip of the hat to all the folks at the mic, and thanks so much for the clearance for getting us on your station. To begin the hour, to begin our show, I was at the Talkers Convention. This is sort of an industry event. Well, not sort of. It is one of the largest industry events in the talk radio business over the weekend. I was on a panel with a bunch of people, and it was interesting. I mean, there was some, you know, pretty good stuff, some pretty boring stuff, you know, the usual. There was one, in particular, one panel about the state of black radio in America, and I think it was meta to the state of black America, African Americans in relationship to all the other races in the United States, but in particular in relationship to what is sometimes referred to as white America. And one of the points that was made by one of the panelists was that in many cities, in most urban areas, black talk radio, African-American talk radio, outperforms things like Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, white talk radio. And yet, for every dollar, actually, when you compare it on the dollar per listener point of view, for every dollar that white talk radio is getting, or white radio is getting, for lack of a better phrase, and really there is no such phrase, but for purposes of discussion, black radio is getting somewhere between 60 and 80 cents, depending on whose numbers we were talking to. And Dr. Jesse Lee Peterson was on the panel. He was recommended to Michael Harrison by Sean Hannity, and did himself well, did a good job of representing Sean Hannity's worldview on this. In fact, got a lot of applause from the mostly conservative audience. I wanted to get him on and get into some of these issues because I so wanted to jump into this conversation, but, of course, I was in the audience. Dr. Jesse Lee Peterson is with us, and welcome, sir.
Welcome. Good morning. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Great to have you with us. And your website, by the way, is bondinfo.org. In fact, I have it up on my computer right now. Brotherhood Organization of a New Destiny, bondinfo.org. And a fine website it is.
Thank you.
Should I call you Jesse or Jesse Lee?
Call me Jesse or Jesse Lee.
Okay. Well, whatever your choice is.
Whatever makes you happy.
Your take on why it is that rating for rating point, AQH, average quarter hour, I mean, I don't want to get into too much inside radio jargon, but I think
right.
that this is meta to everything else right across the board. Why is it that largely urban stations, largely African-American listenership stations, for the exact same number of listeners, get fewer dollars from Madison Avenue?
Well, I mean, there could be many reasons. One is that, most liberal blacks, most, are very angry and racist toward white Americans. And they have this attitude that white folks owe them something. And if they don't give it to them, then somehow or another they are racist.
But we're talking about the marketplace here. I'd like to actually even expand this into the campaign, because here we have Barack Obama, the first African-American candidate for president, and I'm wondering if this is going to be meta to the campaign. In other words, you know, is the Obama presidency, although he's really, I guess, arguably so recently of more mixed race heritage. His mother was white. He was raised in a white family. But nonetheless, you're suggesting, and you were suggesting on the panel, that African-American programs, African-Americans in general, should just basically get over it and get with the program. The fact of the matter is, let me just tell you a quick story, Jesse.
Okay.
Rob Call, who runs Op-Ed News, he was at the conference. He and I were going from down on 28th and 8th Avenue up to the conference. So we're standing there in 8th Avenue, and we walked out of the street, walked off the sidewalk onto the street, and we noticed that 20 feet uptown from us, in other words, we walked out in front of, as the taxis were coming up the road, we jumped line. There was an African-American man and a white woman, a couple, and they were trying to grab a taxi, and they had apparently been there a bit. And so we realized we had kind of jumped line on them. So the first cab that comes pulls up to us. And I said to the guy, they were here first. Go pull up to them. I'll take the next cab. The guy takes one look at him and says, no way. And he drives off. Second cab comes up and the exact same thing happens. Second cab comes up, pulls up to us, two white guys. And I said, you know, we're second in line. Go to them. I'll take the next cab. He takes a look at them. He drives off. It took three cabs before a cab would drive up and pick up the black guy. Now, if you look at the history of the United States, I mean, it's been only largely since the 50s, Brown versus Board of Education, the 60s, the Civil Rights Act, the 70s, that there's been anything resembling at least legal parity in the United States. And there's still massive discrimination in the United States. I would submit to you, and I would have had I been on the panel last night, that the reason why Black Talk Radio gets 60 cents on the dollar is because there's a perception, and in some cases a reality in some parts of the country, that African Americans are making 60 cents on the dollar, and therefore advertising to them is not worth as much as advertising to whites. And this is a reflection of endemic racism in our society.
Well, I can't explain what happened in that cab situation, example you just gave, but I can tell you when I travel, I do a lot of it, and I'm in a cab, I ask about those things sometimes. I say to them, you know, I hear a lot of black folks say that cab drivers are discriminated against them by not picking them up at times, and why is that? Is it true, and why is it? And many of them have told me that it's not necessarily because they're black, but they find themselves in bad situations many times when they are picking up some black folks, and that sometimes they have a problem in paying. Most of them don't tip. And then in many cases, especially in places like Washington, D.C. and New York, parts of New York, they'll pick up a black passenger, and when they get to the destination, they jump out and run and don't pay.
Oh, come on.
And
this is, so, that's the worst kind of stereotype.
If you're going to call it stereotyping, then how will you ever deal with what's really going on?
Well, these kind of stories feed into the fact that unemployment among blacks is more than double of that of whites. And I would submit to you that the reason why is because if you have a black family and a white family who are both making, let's say, $50,000 a year, right? They both have a job at the post office.
Right.
The white family is likely to have at least three times as much wealth, intergenerational wealth. In other words, they own their home. Their parents owned their home. Their parents had wealth. There is a huge disparity. The average African-American family, this is 2001, the last year I could find statistics. Average black family in the United States had a net worth of $19,000. Average white family in the United States, $121,000. This includes home equity.
I know, but there are stats out there that shows you that with black families who are married, with the two parents in home, husband mm-hmm. and wife, they're doing as well, and in many cases better than white families where there are two parents in home. The problem in the black community is that you have 70% of black babies born out of wedlock. Nationwide, and in the state of Indiana, one state alone, you have 80% of black babies born out of wedlock. So when you have these children born with one parent in the home, you're going to have this type of
I lived in Atlanta for 15 years. I certainly saw the black middle class, and it's large and substantial, and a large group of very poor people. But unemployment is the major driver of divorce among all people. And when you've got people who are having a hard time getting and keeping a job, you're going to have divorce.
Well, unemployment is not the driving force of divorce.
Black unemployment is twice what white unemployment is.
It's not because of divorce, though. That doesn't cause divorce. Black folks are not getting married. They're having their children out of wedlock, so they'll never even get it married. But those who do get married are doing very well.
Jesse, can you stick around for a minute?
I sure can.
Great. We got to take a break here. I'd like to get your thoughts on why that might be. It is 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. And also, what is this going to mean for this upcoming presidential election?
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Your radio support group for We the People.
The hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Jesse Lee Peterson, the Reverend Jesse Lee Peterson is with us. Bond, his organization, Brotherhood Organization of New Destiny, bondinfo.org is his website. And Jesse, what role do you think that race is going to be playing in this election?
Very good question. First, I want to say, Tom, you saw how rude and nasty and mean that black panelists were with me, right?
Well, I suspect some of them would say the same about you. No offense.
No, but
there was a spirited discussion. Let's agree on that.
You were one of the observer, and I'm sure you can see where the hostility was coming from. Well, that's typical within the black community. Most black Americans are suffering not because of racism, but the lack of moral character. They like character, and that's why they're suffering like this.
But character is a multi-generational thing. Character is something that comes about as a result of the way that you were raised. And the way you were raised is a function of the way that your parents were raised. And the way
right.
that they were raised is a function of the way their grandparents were raised.
That's right.
And when you've got 400 years of institutionalized racism, just in my lifetime, and an African-American man who whistled at a white woman was murdered, a teenager, Emmett Till. You're familiar with this. When you've got that kind of a world, it's a very different thing.
I grew up on a plantation in Alabama. I remember for colors only sign, for whites only. The plantation that I grew up on, my grandparents, my parents, their parents, their parents, their parents lived there. Right. And they worked that plantation. I went to a movie once down in Alabama. And because I was black, we had to sit in the balcony. But we did not have the type of hostility coming from black America that you see today. There was a sense of respect for
Well, this was
another.
Pat Buchanan's point, was that back then blacks knew their place and therefore
no,
there was no problem.
It's not that they knew their place. It's just that they had this sense of moral character that directed them through life. But over the last 50 years, black Americans most have depended on the government and these racist so-called black leaders like Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, Louis Farrakhan, and most of the racist black preachers. And so you have a generation of black Americans who have lost the ability to take care of themselves by blaming white folks. And we're going to see more of this with this race between Barack Obama and John McCain. You have 90 to 95% of black Americans supporting Barack Obama because he's black.
Oh, wait a minute. Those same African Americans were supporting Hillary Clinton when Barack Obama was in the race.
But
they didn't start supporting him until they heard what he had to say.
Right.
You're suggesting is that African Americans are essentially so dumb they're just going to vote their race. I don't buy it.
Well, they've been dumb enough to stay on the plantation of the Democratic Party for the last 50 years.
The Democratic Party has been a progressive force for the last 50 years. It was the Democratic Party over the objections of the Republicans like Strom Thurmond with his long filibuster who passed the Civil Rights Act.
No, that's not true. The Democratic Party fought against the Civil Rights Act.
Lyndon Johnson signed that legislation into law.
Right.
Against the advice of his advisors.
Yeah, he happened to be, because he was the president at the time, but it was the Democratic Party who fought against the Civil Rights Bill for black Americans.
I will agree with you. Back in the 30s, the Democratic Party was a very racist party. I would say to you that since the 60s, the Republicans said, hey, the racists are leaving the Democratic Party. We'll take them.
Well, the Democratic Party is still a racist party. Look at what happened between Hillary and Barack Obama. I mean, real racism came forth within the Democratic Party. And I have to tell you, Tom, unless white Americans start dealing with the racism of black Americans, this thing is only going to get worse instead of getting better. We have black Americans have accused white folks of being racist. Many white people have examined themselves. If they are, they managed to overcome. But they have told black people that they can't be a racist because they don't own, quote unquote, own anything. And now racism toward white
Jesse,
Americans.
Jesse, I'll be the first to acknowledge that there's racism on both sides.
Yeah.
There's racism among every race. I've sat with Native American groups who made jokes about other Native American groups. I mean, this is part of the human condition to a certain extent. Where it becomes destructive is when it's used to oppress other people economically.
When you saw the racism toward me on that panel when they were calling me
Uncle That was not racism. That was political disagreement.
No, they called me Uncle Tom, a fool, a sellout. I mean, that's racism from black on black racism. Would you agree?
Well, not being black myself, I those words may have a different meaning to you and the people on the panel than they did to me. It looked like it was a political argument between you guys about things that had to do with race.
When they went to name calling, Uncle Tom, a fool and a sellout. Those words are set up to hurt you and to try to hold you back.
But that was not the majority of the discussion. The majority of the discussion was they were pointing out the fact that black radio... Pardon?
They were lying, first of all. It's not true. On my radio show, my message is for all of mankind. And so I have all races listening to my show. And many of them, some of them, don't agree. But yet they listen because the message...
So you think racism is not alive and well in the United States except in the black community?
Right. It's more pronounced...
There's no racism in the white community?
No, there is some racism there, but that is not what's holding black people back. What's holding black Americans back is their own hatred toward white Americans and toward anyone who would tell them the truth about what's really going on within themselves. That's where the racism lies.
Well, you know, we live in interesting times. Reverend Jesse Lee Peterson, his website, bondinfo.org, if you want to learn more about his organization. And, sir, thank you very much for dropping by and talking with us. Our number, 866.
Thank you for having me, buddy.
Thank you, Jesse. Good talking with you. 866-303-2270. Your thoughts on this. Where is the real racism in America? And how's it going to play out in this election?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at
866-303-2270. How does it feel?
Isn't it fascinating that there actually is no gene for race? There are genes for things like the color of your skin or the way that your hair is, whether it's curly or whether it's dark or light. There's genes for facial character, individual character. There's thousands of genes, but there is no gene for race. We're all humans with a whole variety of different characteristics and qualities. I remember years ago, back in the 1980, Dick Gregory and I were going over to Africa we had taken over the Numala prison farm during the war with Idi Amin and turned it into a refugee center. It was 81. I went over in 80 and set the thing up, and he came back in 81 with me as a part of a fundraiser. We were trying to raise, awareness of what was going on. And he asked me this question on the plane, and I still think about it from time to time. You know, he said, if you and I could have a child, you know, obviously we're two men. He said, but you know, if a white woman and a black man or vice versa have a child, it's black. If a white person and an Asian person has a child, it's called Asian. If a white person and a Native American has a child, it's called Native American. If a white person and a Hispanic has a child, it's called Hispanic. He says, what's wrong with the white race? And I'm like, what? You know, it's like where the, just our whole our we need a fundamental rethinking of, you know, and frankly, I think to a large extent, a setting aside of this whole idea of race. It needs to happen throughout our society. This from the Wall Street Journal. This is the Wall Street Journal. And this goes to my point that white families have had 400 years in the United States to establish a culture of wealth, knowledge of wealth, information about wealth. It's passed right down from parents to children. And wealth itself. Children of black parents earning in the middle 20% of all families. In other words, the absolute right in the middle of the middle class. Black families in the middle class, white families in the middle class. The children, and we're talking intact families, not the, you know, the stereotypes of single people on welfare. And by the way, there are more single people on welfare in the United States who are white than are black. But nonetheless, setting that aside, children of black parents earning the middle 20% of all families in the late 1960s had a 69% chance of earning less than their parents. For white children, that's just 32%. So while Reaganomics, while 40 years of Ronald Reagan tearing apart the social fabric of the New Deal and destroying America has hit all of us pretty hard. Among whites, we're just 32% less well off. The children of my generation, the kids coming up now, they're just 32% worse off than their parents were. Among blacks, 69% worse off. That's a huge difference. I mean, that is an absolutely substantial difference. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. D in St. Louis, is it Missouri or Michigan, D? My screen says Michigan, but I'm guessing it's Missouri. D?
How are you?
Hey, D. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm a first-time caller. It's cool listening to your show.
Thank you.
The gentleman who was just, I guess his name was Jesse?
Yeah, Jesse Lee Peterson.
Yeah, I found him incredibly offensive. He made some statements, and I'm an African-American female. In my 30s, I do think that there are generational gaps within the African-American community whereby racism is more prominent among some of the older of our community.
Yeah, this is true in the white community as well, by the way.
Yeah, and that was actually going to sort of segue me into my next point, that as we've come along, I think now divisions exist more along socioeconomic lines than just racial lines. Things get pronounced when they start slicing and dicing demographics for the sake of politics and other things. But I don't think on a day-to-day basis it is as pronounced. Please, I'm not saying that racism doesn't exist. We know it does.
Yeah.
We know that misogyny exists. We know that sexism exists. I mean, all of these things exist. But to make the broad, sweeping statements that your last guest made, it's just offensive. He was called a fool, not because people were racist, but because it was just foolish statements. They were uninformed.
Yeah.
They reflect a time bygone. Jesse Jackson, you know, survey a group of African Americans, 30 in their 30s.
But D, his point is it's time to move on. And what I'm saying is, you know, that's all well and good, and we would love to move on, and we'd all love to have a colorblind society. But the fact of the matter is that today, in 2008, an African-American man, woman, couple, looking for an apartment, looking for a job, looking for any kind of opportunity in the United States is still at a disadvantage. There still is institutional racism, some of it within the black communities, some of it within the white community. It's still there. How do we deal with that? How do we get rid of that?
I think that one of the things, and I'll speak to why I support Barack Obama, and I'll speak to one of the things I appreciate about his candidacy, is that unlike his competitor, when he was faced with obvious racism, and there has been racism, I mean, the fact that every African-American national candidate has to apologize or somehow rebuke and denounce Farrakhan and every other black leader that's ever said anything remotely controversial.
Right, just because they happen to have the same color of skin, whereas John McCain is not being asked to rebuke the KKK.
Absolutely, but here's what he does, and here is what I was always taught to model, and I grew up, even in my 30s, I grew up affected by racism. We had racial epithets bleached in our yard. My husband had crosses burned in his yard. He's actually a public speaker and speaks a lot about forgiveness and healing. I do think that there is an element within us that has to say, I'm going to rise above it. And it's possible. And I think he sets a great example of how you can rise above the fray, how you can stick to issues, how you can, you know, one of the things I do hold against my community, and I speak about it a lot of younger African-American males, is that before you can accuse, you have to remove all of the obstacles. You have to work hard. You have to achieve. You can't expect to get favor because of your race any more than you should expect to be discriminated against.
Although at the same time, there are, I'm still in favor of affirmative action programs until we reach that point where there is actual parity. Dee, I appreciate the call. I got to move along, but interesting. Charles in Los Angeles, listening to K-Talk. Hey, Charles.
Yes. Well, the best affirmative action is for black Americans to support each other in business and treat each other better. That's the best thing that black Americans can do.
But isn't that also creating a silo? Isn't that creating a we're in this community, you're in that community kind of thing?
No. I mean, it's something that's required in capitalism. I mean, right now, about 5% of every dollar that black Americans spend goes to black businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what would happen to whites, Jews, Hispanics, Asians, anybody else if they had that economic policy going on where they only spent 5% with their own group?
Yeah, but you could say, for example, you know, teenagers, you know, they don't spend money with teenagers. Women don't necessarily ask if a business is woman run before they buy something. These elderly people don't ask, is this an elderly person's business? Groups that to some extent experience the consequences of something that could be called discrimination. Clearly nothing is serious. Well, with women, I would say sexism and misogyny are probably right up there with racism, but, you know, with the other exceptions. What about the idea of taking over? You know, I talk about take over progressives should take over the Democratic Party rather than simply promote it. What about, you know, participating? Well, I guess this is what Barack Obama's doing. I mean, you know, here he's running for president. Talk about taking over the party.
Exactly. And that's a good thing. But for us to fully participate, we have to have a certain economic status.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And so that's important. I'm not saying that we should spend all our money with each other, but we're just, I'd like to see more than 5%, so they get it up to 10 or 20%. You'll see a lot more people employed. You'll see a lot more families taken together. You made a great point. I mean, the number one reason why couples break up is economics.
Yeah, and that's regardless of race right across the board. Charles, thanks a lot for the call. Cookie in Little Rock, Arkansas. Hey, Cookie.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just livid, really, listening to Jesse Lee Peterson. Let me come from a different aspect. I am a someone who has studied history and genealogy for about 20 years.
Mm.
And the way that I see it, he basically is saying that it's because black people as a group are amoral. That's what the problem is. My parents lived together until my father passed away. They married way back in the 40s and stayed married forever.
Oh, in other words, he's saying that they're not teaching their children the values. I think you could actually make a case that there is a culture being promoted by corporate America that's destructive to African Americans.
Well, yes, and let me just say this. Let me make this quick point. Just because you say something's wrong, you disagree with it. Just because, you know, victim, that word is somehow a bad word.
Yeah.
We have been victimized. I look at it this way. My father fought in World War II. My mother was a Rosie the Riveter in a country where they couldn't vote.
Yeah.
Would that make them bitter? Perhaps. I am of mixed race. My mother, my grandmother, my paternal grandmother was Native American and Irish.
Mm-hmm.
And her husband, my grandfather, was black.
I think probably a good chunk of America is of mixed
Absolutely.
Race.
Absolutely.
Know, probably
Arkansas,
more than the majority.
That is very true. The Trail of Tears came right through here.
Yeah. Cookie, thanks a lot for the call. I've got to wrap it up here for this segment because we've got to take a break. But your point was well made. Thank you very much for calling in and sharing it with us. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. You want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com as well for all things Air America there. Stick around. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm glad about in our Caught You Doing Something Right alert this week. Congratulations to the mayor of Minneapolis. He says, cutting down on idling is something we can all do for our environment, our health, and the health of our neighbors. For the average driver, reducing idling saves money on fuel. On average, a car will burn more than half a gallon of fuel for every hour spent idling. And 10 seconds idling uses more fuel than restarting the car. I'll tell you, when I first moved to Germany, when I first started visiting Germany back in the early 70s, or Europe in general, but in particular Germany, I noticed that people would pull up to a light and they turn off their cars. And I thought, this is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. I thought maybe there was some law. There was no law. People were just doing it because gas cost $6 a gallon back then, and it was a way of saving gas. And it worked, and now Minneapolis is going to apparently institutionalize. I think it's a fine thing. So, anyway, there is that. Jason in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Jason, listening to WTKG. What's up?
Hey, how you doing? First of all, Reverend Peterson, like most black conservatives, has particularly acutely thin skin. And, you know, really so because, you know, black people with the level of political sophistication, I mean, as compared with other political groups, racial, broken down along racial lines, black folks are usually more politically sophisticated than, say, white people or Hispanics. Secondly,
May I inject? I suspect that if that's the case, and it certainly seems to be the case, that and they're also much larger consumers of talk radio, by the way, and we know that for a fact, white and black talk radio, that's
right.
Because if you're an oppressed minority in a country, it's to your advantage to know what the hell's going on.
Right.
So, go ahead.
And so the second point is that with the amoral questions, I think that's kind of twisted in a sense, because what really is at work there is, you know, economics. And, you know, going back to the conservative versus liberals issue, conservatives have no love for, you know, black people. And they've proven that with, you know, during the Reagan era and, you know, during this current administration. The tax cuts have really decimated, you know, not only overall middle class purchasing power, but it's really acutely affected, you know, black people in particular,
right,
more so than any other group.
Because they don't have generations of wealth. They don't, by and large, have the kind of equity coming into this recent economy that white families do.
And which translates into political power, because if you don't have money, then, you know, basically you have, you know, pretty much, you know, nothing.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, that's where that amoral question comes in. And it's not really a question of morality, but, you know, it's economics. If people don't have the economics to sit down with the family. And, you know, because my dad, you know, he worked two jobs. You know, my mom worked. Mm. But, you know, there was enough time between all of that, you know, for them to sit down with us and let us know what it was that was expected of us, you know, as individuals, you know, within the family, within the community.
Right.
And, you know, these were all things that, you know, were relayed downward. But if, you know, people are so at struggle, you know, with the economic aspects of their lives, then, you know, it's really hard to think about, you know, well, you know, what do I do? When do I have time, you know, sit down with the family?
And this is one of the reasons why I think even in poor white communities in Appalachia, for example, and other poor white communities around the country, you see very high divorce rates, you see high crime rates, you see high rates of racism and xenophobia and homophobia and all the other phobias and fears and hatreds that are associated basically with poverty that come out of, you know, not having your basic needs met. So you look for somebody to say, oh, well, that's the reason why, you know, they're the ones. It must be those nasty brown people from Mexico who are taking my jobs, you know, or whatever. I mean, you know, that's where it all comes from. You know,
people looking all over the place except where it actually counts, which is the economics.
That's right. Bottom line, it's always the dollars. Jason, thank you very much. Very well said. Norman in Washington, D.C., you want to disagree?
Hey, Tom.
Hey,
yeah, very much so. I can't see how I've heard you a few times beat up on white people about racist things they've done or anything just throughout this conversation, but when Reverend Peterson does it, he's a sellout. When he, you know, calls,
I didn't call him a sellout. I thought I was very respectful for it.
This weekend, they disrespect Peterson all the time. I've seen him speak, and he's probably a little too blind to racism. But I would say, in the same token, you may have a little liberal white guilt, and I think that you can't see it's not a white person that makes a black guy make babies and not not stay with the wife, not stay with the woman. You were talking about divorce rates. These people aren't getting married.
Sure.
They're just having children out of wedlock at 70, 75%. White people are around 15, 20%.
Well, it depends on, it depends on what economic group you're looking at.
Sir, but there's no excuse for not wearing a condom when you're trying to have sex with a woman. I mean, let's be serious.
I agree.
You're not stupid where you don't know. Look at our age rate in Washington, D.C. I lived in West Virginia as well.
So what is it, Norman? If you're of the opinion that if you're of the opinion that black people are doing this to themselves,
no.
Why?
See, that's the problem. You want to paint me as that? I'm telling you, it's a little of both.
What is causing this?
I'm sorry.
What is causing this?
I think almost like you say, when you've enslaved a people, then it's a normal progression for them to try to be reinstated in society and brought up to terms. If you look at us from slavery to the day, we're still constantly moving forward. I understand sometimes we look grim and maybe our situation is as good as what you would think. But like you said, white people have old money to work with.
Yeah.
You know, we're trying to get new money. So it takes some time. Not 200 years is not a long time. For some reason, people think that's not a long time in history.
Well, and really 50-60 years since Brown versus Board of Education.
I think it helps us to just say constantly. And brother, you too, you being a stalwart for civil rights in the country, it doesn't really help to constantly. You have to place blame where blame is. And you need to beat up on black people just as much as you beat up on white.
As I said, I'm not denying black racism. But I'm also
racism. That's silly. I'm talking about we have to take care of ourselves. We have to stop making babies and not marrying the women. Stop sleeping around. Stop having AIDS.
Yeah, this is Bill Cosby's speech. And Norman, I think you're spot on right. So the question is, what you're talking about, all the stuff you're talking to, is how do you heal a culture? And what causes the wounds in that culture that need the healing? And that's the larger conversation that I hope we can have. Norman, thanks for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program, where progressives come to party.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. At what point, we were talking in the last hour about race and politics in the United States and what role they're going to play. I at some point through this week or next, I also want to get into the issue of gender in politics. I think that there's fertile territory there as well. There's an enormous amount of there has been a huge wounding in this country, and sexism and racism are very much alive. And let's take it to the larger picture. To the extent that whites or blacks or men and women may be fighting over the crumbs, essentially, as Charles Dickens would have portrayed it, of an economy that serves by and large the very, very wealthy and powerful, who by and large are white males in the United States. But even setting aside the racial or sexual aspects of it or gender aspects of it, at what point are we as Americans willing to stand up and say, no, we're not going to allow the landed gentry. We're not going to allow the super wealthy. We're not going to allow the small number of very powerful corporations and a few thousand families. And make no mistake about it, there's not even 200,000 families in the United States who are making over $10 million a year in income. We're just talking about a very small minority of people who are bringing in vast amounts of wealth, or who have vast amounts of wealth. And at what point do we say profits over humanity, not something we're willing to put up with anymore? You know, one of the reasons why, and David Sirota talks about this in his book, The Uprising, one of the reasons why I think this is going to be a really significant election, I was on this panel of talkers this weekend. Every single person, the last question Alan Colmes asked us all, and I was sitting there with Monica Crowley and Lionel and Lars Larson, a bunch of other people, and the last question that Alan Colmes asked was, who's going to win the election? And everybody on the panel except me said John McCain. And I said, I think it's going to be Barack Obama. And let me tell you why. Because in the 30s, in the 1930 election, the majority of people, when they were asked, do you trust government or do you trust big corporations? Because ultimately that's what it boils down to. People say, well, you should have the John McCain's health care program, right? You should have the right to choose your health care program. In other words, it's between you and a big corporation. As opposed to, for example, Barack Obama's program, who he says, well, yeah, you should be able to choose your provider and the government will pay the bill. It's between you and the government. Now, I'll tell you, if William McGuire, who had retired last year with his $1.78 billion compensation package over the last 10 years, the head of the second largest health insurance company in the United States, the company that provides most of the health insurance through AARP, which is basically an insurance company these days. If I was upset with the quality of the service that I was getting from Bill McGuire's company, and I tried to call him, and I called him every single day and said, listen, I've got, and started sending him letters and stood out in front of his office with a sign saying, you know, Bill McGuire's company's ripping me off, they would throw my butt in jail. That's called criminal harassment. That's trespassing. It's private property. You can't do that. But if we had a national health care system in this country and I felt like I wasn't being dealt with appropriately, that I wasn't getting the care I needed, that my children weren't getting the care they needed, and I went down to my member of Congress's office and stood out front with a sign, I am constitutionally protected in doing that by the First Amendment. If I called them every single day, if I sent letters every day, it's all part of my First Amendment rights. So what are we going to do? Trust government or trust the corporations? At what point is profit versus humanity the big deal? For example, drugs. Let me just, this really concerns me. Back, you know, most of you who've been listening to this program for years and years know that I've written 7 out of the 19 books I have in print right now. And, 4 Project Censored Award winners, New York Times bestseller. Of the 19 books I have in print, 7 of them are about psychiatry, psychology, or attention deficit disorder, or education. And I used to speak at a lot of conferences on ADHD, and I always thought it was interesting. As the bottom of the food chain in that industry, I was rostered by the state of Vermont as a psychotherapist. One step up from that is the psychologists who get certified. One step up from that is the psychiatrists who are licensed. And if I spoke, and speaking at these conferences, and a number of my friends, I've developed good friendships over the years with a number of people who are psychiatrists and psychologists and in the field, the ADD field. And they would tell me how, oh, yeah, I'm getting $5,000 for this speech, or I'm getting $10,000 for this speech, or, you know, I'd give speeches in Europe, and they'd talk about how they were flown in first class by the drug companies. And I always just picked it up on my own nickel, or else my publisher paid for it. Or we would do events where we'd charge $10 a head, and we'd try to raise enough money for me to show up. And the name Joe Biederman kept coming up all the time. He did a lot of research that supported the idea that we should be giving, in particular, Ritalin to our kids. Today's must-read story by Andrew Tilghman, and I've met Joe Biederman, and I always thought he was a decent guy. Oh, I still assume he's a decent guy, but he was like, that was the name. Everybody in the ADD industry knew that name. And I was out there saying, well, you know, these kids are just, you know, they're hunters in a farmer's world. They think in a way that doesn't necessarily work well in our public school. But if you modified the schools, they could be brilliant. They could do very, very well. And in fact, I've seen that in my own life, in my own family, and in many, many of the kids and people. In any case, the system, Andrew Tilghman, writing in Talking Point Memo today, TPM Muckraker, system designed to keep corporate cash from secretly slipping into the hands of doctors who do highly influential medical research isn't working well. This is the front page of the New York Times, congressional probe. Some child psychiatrists are earning over $1 million a year in undisclosed consulting fees from drug firms. And then they added, this has helped fuel an explosion in the use of powerful antipsychotic medicines for children. Dr. Joseph Biederman is one of the most influential researchers. This is from the New York Times. Is one of the most influential researchers in child psychiatry and is widely admired for focusing the field's attention on its most troubled young patients. Although many of his studies are small and often financed by drug makers, his work has helped to fuel a controversial 40-fold increase. That's 4,000%, a 40-fold increase from 1994 to 2003 in the diagnosis of pediatric childhood bipolar disorder, which is characterized by severe mood swings, and in the rapid rise in the use of antipsychotic medications in children. The Grassley investigation did not address the research quality. This guy works at Harvard School of Medicine. He received $1.6 million from the pharmaceutical companies between 2000 and 2007, but for years did not report much of this income to university officials, according to information given congressional investigators. So we've got that, number one. Number two, biotech giants demanding a high price for saving the planet. Companies accused of profiteering as they attempt to patent crop genes. Here we have giant biotech companies privatizing the world's food supply. Why? Well, because the price of food is going up. The population of the planet is going up. Food is the one thing you absolutely must have. At what point do we say, no, you can't patent life forms? You can't go to India and take the oil from the neem tree and say, we now own the patent on the neem tree. You can't take Taxol from the pine tree out in Southern California and say, we now own this tree, the genetics of this tree. This is nuts. Monsanto's business, the ETC group, calls this opportunistic public relations strategy. Nine firms have filed 532 patents around the world on 55 different genes offering protection against heat, drought, and floods in plants. If granted, the companies would be given control of crucial natural raw material needed to maintain food supplies in an increasingly hungry world. Small farmers in developing countries, this by Jeffrey Lean in the Independent today, small farmers in developing countries will be particularly hard hit because what's happening? Climate change. Climate change is coming. It's getting drier. The deserts are moving. The droughts are increasing. So we need more drought-resistant plants. So, yeah, let's make them genetically and then own them. And then on top of that, we found from Jay Rockefeller last week, and again, this is, in my opinion, this falls into the category of profits before people, that over and over and over again, the Bush administration lied us into the war in Iraq. Now, just looking back on that, who has benefited? The buddies of the Bush administration. They have made billions with a B. They have made billions of dollars on this so-called war on terror, on the occupation, on the six-year occupation of Iraq. $8 billion missing. Physical $100 bills, stacks of $100 bills, big enough to see from outer space, missing. Trillions of dollars that we're going to spend. They have bankrupted this country. Why? A, political power. B, make money for their buddies. Back with your calls.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Where despair is not an option.
Get active.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Minutes past the hour. See, there are absolute limits to the so-called free market. I got to tell you, there are just absolute limits to it. And to tie the first hour back into the second hour here, in the second hour we're talking about economics and how here we have giant corporations patenting our food supplies. You've got giant corporations buying the water supplies of communities all over the world and selling it back to people in ways that they can't afford to pay for them themselves. People are dying as a result of privatization. You've got the privatization of our roads, which were built after through eminent domain. We took people's property away, completely changed the nature of the land, and it's being sold to corporations at its current value rather than what it could have been had eminent domain not happened in the first place. And where is the profit going from these toll roads? It's going to Spain, by and large. It's going to France. The French own the largest private water companies in the world. The profits are going to France. So here we have over and over and over again profits being put before people. And I think that it is time for us to say no. No more are we going to say that the corporations, the giant corporations who have always tried to run this country, no more are we going to let them do that. And, for example, this is Jack Kennedy and Richard Nixon. I mean, just emblematic of this whole thing. Nixon and Kennedy were in their first debate in 1960, and the question was, okay, Brown versus Board of Education in 1954 was put forward as it was a law. You had to integrate the schools. But the law didn't say you had to integrate the lunch counters. And so Nixon says, so the question was, how are you going to integrate the lunch counters in America? Keep in mind, this was 1960. You know, people say, oh, you know, racism is long gone. 1960. So first, Richard Nixon had his answer. This was his response.
I have talked to Negro mothers. I've heard them try to explain how they tell their children how they can go into a store and buy a loaf of bread, but then can't go into that store and sit at the counter and get a Coca-Cola.
And Nixon's suggestion, and he lays it right out here, was to go to the corporations and ask them to play nice.
This is wrong, and we have to do something about it. So under the circumstances, what do we do? Well, what we do is what the Attorney General of the United States did under the direction of the President. Call in the owners of chain stores and get them to take action.
Now, keep in mind, Nixon was vice president at the time. And so he was saying, yeah, our attorney general, we called in the owners of chain stores and we said, please do something. And they laughed at him. So John Kennedy says, no, sorry, there is a role for government to play here in protecting people whether they're being discriminated on the basis of race or on gender or anything else. And by the way, we're going to put more money into doing that. And this is John Kennedy.
Well, Mr. Nixon hasn't discussed the two basic questions. What is going to be done and what will be his policy on implementing the Supreme Court decision of 1954? Giving aid to schools technically that are trying to carry out the decision is not the great question. Secondly, what's he going to do to provide fair employment? He's been the head of the Committee on Government Contracts. It's carried out two cases, both in the District of Columbia. He has not indicated his support of an attempt to provide fair employment practices around the country.
Now, that was, you know, basically Nixon was in charge of hiring people in Washington, D.C., and they weren't hiring blacks. And that was fine with Nixon. This is what Kennedy was pointed out.
So that everyone can get a job regardless of their race or color. Nor has he indicated that he would support Title III, which would give the Attorney General additional powers to protect constitutional rights. These are the great questions. Equality of education in school. About 2% of our population of white people is illiterate. 10% of our colored population. 60-70% of our colored children do not finish high school. These are the questions in these areas that the North and the Southeast and West are entitled to know. What will be the leadership of the President in these areas to provide equality of opportunity for employment, equality of opportunity in the field of housing, which could be done on all federal-supported housing by a stroke of the President's pen? What will be done to provide equality of education in all sections of the United States? Those are the questions to which the President must establish a moral tone and moral leadership. And I can assure you that if I'm elected president, we will do so.
And they did. And it was an era that lasted all too short, but they did. Mark in Laramie, New Mexico. Hey, Mark. Got about a minute before this break.
I just have a couple of points. I love your show, and I almost always agree with everything you say, but I just wanted to add 2 points. When you say, how are we going to change this imposition of a government by the wealthy, I think we're at a huge disadvantage because they have, what is it, like 30 or 40 law enforcement organizations, DEA, NIS, ICE, FBI, and their main objective is to defend the wealth of the wealthy. And it's not a coincidence that we also have the most people in the world per capita capita in jail. Mm-hmm. And they're all mostly poor people. The other thing I would like to say is, as you were saying, how can we change the culture of the African Americans? And you mentioned that 80% of the families in Indiana are single families.
No, I didn't mention that. My guest did, and I frankly don't know if it's true or not.
Well,
but the bottom line. And I'm sorry, Mark, we're out of time. But the bottom line is, we do need to be addressing these issues as a nation, collectively. And the answer isn't simply to go to the owners of the chain stores and say, hey, help. No. 27 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
They still think I'm a star. Hear neighbors trust their neighbors. That's why I tap their phones. It keeps their freedom ringing. Yeah, I feel less alone. Even though I love them, that's just where I'm at. This size of rumor has it that one's a Democrat. Let's go to Mars. Forget about your cares. Let's go to Mars. We'll bring a case of beer, let's go to Mars. Bet the hunting's good, I'll bag me one of those aliens. And mount 'em on my hood, let's go to Mars.
It's got to be the best song George W. Bush ever recorded, right? Or never recorded. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program, by the way, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Colombia. Find out more about that over at Teamster.org for all that information. And some strange news out there. Recently unsealed court documents records show more light on the federal government's attempt to secure the online book purchase records of 24,000 Amazon.com customers. The government wants to know what you and I are reading. When Amazon turned them down, the government came back with a request for only 120 customers, but Amazon still refused. When the case then the government took it to U.S. Magistrate Judge Stephen Crocker. They took it before him, and he said the subpoena is troubling because it permits the government to peek into the reading habits of specific individuals without their knowledge or permission. It is an unsettling and un-American scenario. This is the federal judge. To envision federal agents nosing through the reading lists of law-abiding citizens while hunting for evidence against somebody else. Number one. And number two, all they need in Cheyenne, Wyoming is $5 and a good throwing arm. Four Democratic candidates for federal office have volunteered to get dunked in chili water at the annual Jackalope Days Festival in Douglas, about 115 miles north of Cheyenne. You know the old story. You get a Democrat, you stick him in the booth, you throw the ball. If you hit the target, bloop, they go into the cold water. The only problem, there's a 4-to-1 ratio of registered Republicans to Democrats there. If I were a Democrat, I don't believe I would have done that. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Brendan in Birmingham, Michigan, listening on WDTW in Detroit. Hey, Brendan.
Hey, Tom. You know, can you hear me?
Yeah, just fine.
All right, great. You know, I'm starting to become a biomedical researcher, and I wanted to talk about these gene sequencing and patents. And not to make a pun, but I do think it's patently ridiculous that these genes are being sequenced because they are a natural resource. None of these.
Well, it's appropriate that they're sequenced. It's not appropriate that they then be turned into the private property of a particular corporation.
Right.
And in fact, much of the sequencing is being done by or paid for by federal agencies or federal dollars.
Yes, by universities, which speaks to the very murky relationship between universities and corporations.
That's right. In fact, most drugs are developed by universities with funding from the National Institutes of Health. And then the corporations, who are now calling themselves in their ads, by the way, your drug research, your pharmaceutical research companies, you know, nonsense. Come on, give me a break. Yeah, no, well said, Brennan. It is just plain old flat out wrong. Jessica, thank you for the call. Jessica in Missoula, Montana, listening on KLCY. Hey, Jessica.
Hey, how you doing? Really good topics today. As for the whole gene patenting thing, what's really disgusting, I do a lot of research, and actually I'm in the process of creating an organization for scientific integrity and debate because of it. But with they actually are privatizing our disease. They are patenting aspects of our disease. Pharma is. Big pharma. They can patent an aspect of the breast cancer gene, then they can delegate the price for you to search and see if someone has a predisposition. They're now raising it up to like $6,000. And if you want to research that disease,
you
they
have to
have
pay
the right
them
to
for
tell
access
you.
To the gene.
They have the right to tell you that you can't. So if you're
living organisms should not be patentable. That's what it comes down to, whether it's a disease, whether it's a body, whether it's a or whether it's a plant. I mean, it should be just that simple. And frankly, you know, the unintended consequence of that, at least over the short term, would probably be that there'd be a lot more toxic drugs and a lot fewer natural plant medicines. You know, about half of the total half of the total pharmacopoeia of the United States is actually plant medicines that are sold as pharmaceuticals, plant extracts. But, you know, maybe you could patent the combination of them or patent the way they're presented or something like that so they can make money selling them, but being able to keep other people from using them. I mean, this is what happened in India with the neem tree. Jessica, spot on. Thank you very much. This is so, so very wrong. David in Miami. Hey, David.
Yeah, hi. I'm listening to you for a while. It's a good program.
Thank you.
I agree that the corporations are taking over or have taken over the country already, but I think it's our fault. I can cite you one example. California, when the people passed the law that the auto companies had to produce cars that got so much mileage per gallon. And the companies fought it, but the people passed the law. And for a while, the companies had to follow it. General Motors came out with the electric car then. That worked.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, an excellent point. And people say, well, you know, we should get our government off our back. It shouldn't be meddling, et cetera, et cetera. But the bottom line is that if you allow the government, if you allow the free market, the so-called free market, to regulate how things are going to be, there will be a balancing. It eventually will work out to a certain extent. Over at the Talkers Convention this weekend, I listened, just sitting right next to me, the chairman of one of the largest talk radio networks giving a big speech to somebody about how, you know, see, this is gas prices are up and all of a sudden General Motors is making fuel efficient cars. That proves that the so-called free market works. Well, yeah, it does. But what about the millions of Americans who are stuck with a truck that's getting 10 miles to the gallon who can't afford to drive to work anymore? The way that the free market works is by, after people experience pain, they then start taking remedial action. But sometimes it takes years, and a lot of people's lives get destroyed in the process. And that's no way to run a country. That's no way to run an economy, frankly. And I'm not suggesting that we should have a demand economy. But looking rationally, we the people, as the people, looking rationally and saying, you know, it's particularly after 9/11, it's absolutely nuts that our major export is dollars, our major import is oil, and that those dollars are going to the countries and the people who were involved with, and in many cases supportive of, the people who hit the towers in 9/11. That's crazy. Let's do something about that. Of course, the Bush administration says, oh, we're not going to do anything about that. Those people are our friends. You know, Bandar Bush is my nephew, or for all practical purposes. So, anyway. A lot on the table here. We've talked about race in the first hour, economics in the second hour. Frankly, I don't think that we can separate the two. It's Tony in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Tony.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. How are you doing? I was just going to say, first of all, now you're a very smart man, Tom, and I know you know black people cannot be racist in this country. We can be prejudiced. We cannot like white people. We could do whatever, but we do not have the power of institutionalized racism. I could be have P. Diddy's money. I got millions. I can't deny you anything. I can't deny you education, health care, nothing.
By and large, I mean, there may be a few African Americans who are so wealthy and own big businesses that they could be racist. That is, they could deny economic opportunity to people who are not African-American. But
right.
it is
but
such a minority
matter.
That it's meaningless. You're right.
Right.
I was using
They're
the word
not.
Racism when I should have been using the word discrimination, and thank
exactly.
you for sensitizing
they
me to that.
They can discriminate, yeah, on that, but they probably wouldn't be in business very long.
You're right.
So
and I think most Americans, and particularly most white Americans, don't get that distinction. And
right.
I really honor you, Tony, for calling me up and sharing it with me. I got to move along, but thank you very much for the call. It was great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. Bob in Amherst, Massachusetts. Hey, Bob.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Let's see. A lot of water's got under the bridge here since I got on. As far as this, the children having problems in school with the chemistry is all in this processed food. So when you had that Mars music on there, that's what we got out of our space exploration was the microwave oven. And what goes in the microwave oven? Processed food. And the processed food goes in the kid. The kid goes into school and he's wired with all those unpronounceable names that you'll see on the ingredients.
Right.
Which means you better get to your local farmer's market. If you don't have one, get one. You need,
Excellent point, Bob, and people need to be eating well, bottom line. Absolutely. Jody in Washington State listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Jody.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Just great. What's up?
I just want to let you know racism does still exist, and I've experienced it as a white man from blacks. I mean, more like prejudice. I wouldn't call it racism, but, you know, my wife is a professional woman. She's black, and we moved to the Northwest about 12 years ago, and we were looking to rent because she was right out of residency. And she was shown certain areas of town, but not certain areas that there were houses available that we would want to live in. So when we went up there, we ended up living in a place that I thought was a dump. And like 2 days after we moved in and, you know, got to work and everything got settled, we went driving around town. There were houses for rent, nice house, nice areas. She was never shown those areas.
I'll tell you, when we moved to Atlanta in 1983, three or 84, the real estate agent said to Louise when she first met her, she said, do you want to see the white neighborhoods, the black neighborhoods, or the mixed neighborhoods? And Louise said, I would like to see a different real estate agent. She was so offended by that. She was so offended by that. But, I mean, that was 83. I thought that things had changed since then. But you're saying that you and your African-American wife went through the same thing. Jody, thanks for the call and for, you know, racism and discrimination are both alive and well in the United States. No way around it. As is sexism and misogyny. But the bottom line, it's all about the money. And by and large, it's all about the money for big corporations and for rich white guys. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
News service, talkradionews.com, and my erstwhile traveling companion when 3 months ago we went to the border of Darfur in southern Sudan. That was a great presentation at the Talkers Convention this weekend when Joe Madison was given the Freedom of Speech Award, and they showed a video of us in Sudan and in southern Sudan and on the Darfur region and all the refugees coming back, and the great work, Ellen, that you've done there, that you did down in Louisiana. You've been building a community center for the people who are victims of the hurricane, who both government and certainly the corporations forgot and left behind. I just wanted to tip my hat to you before I brought you on.
Well, I tip my hat to you, and as I've said several times, I'm almost done with Prophet's Way.
By my next trip to Colorado for the conventions next week, the pre-walkthrough, I'll have it done and be able to report to you. But it's a great book. So if anybody's listening to this program, get Tom Hartman's The Prophet's Way. It is a wonderful and very spiritual book.
Thank you. I wasn't looking for a plug.
Meanwhile, less spiritual is this morning at the White House. I actually got up at 6 o'clock in the morning, got my tail to the White House by 6:30 to hear the president's goodbye speech before he goes to the EU-US summit that's happening. It's going to be visiting, I believe, either four or five countries, winding up with the Pope and the new and old Prime Minister of Italy on Thursday. I have to say, if you can give a three-minute rambling speech, the president did that. He sort of touched on all these issues, and I was like, where's he going next? And it was just like a laundry list. We have economic issues. We've made progress in Afghanistan. Laura's reporting to me, but there's still lots of work to do.
Was it a written speech?
We're too dependent on hydrocarbons. I'm going to tell the Europeans about that.
Was this off the cuff, Ellen, or... off the cuff? Was he reading a teleprompter, or was it off the cuff?
No, he was off the cuff.
Oh, no. Well, that's why it was rambling. He hadn't had his Ritalin that day.
I thought to myself, the guy has not had his coffee. You're right. Ritalin, coffee, wonderful day.
You know, according to the, The Sun? I forget. No, one of the tabloids. Louise picked it up in the supermarket yesterday because the cover story was George Bush on cocaine in the White House and, you know, referencing Scotty McClellan and company. And you know, they're pushing it, obviously. You know, it's the tabloids, but they said that all these problems he's having with Laura, it all goes back to drinking and cocaine, and well, who knows.
Well, not to be overlooked, the House committee, and this is House Government and Reform, this is Waxman's committee, they put out a proposed report. Now, this proposed report is actually going to be voted on Thursday. And it has to deal with the committee's findings about Jack Abramoff. I only wish that former Congressman Ney was allowed by the Bureau of Prisons to talk about this because he's got a lot to say about it. But in any case, they won't let him on the air. So there is going to be this vote, and this is talking about did the Abramoff group give any kind of gifts? What was their influence? How many times was he talking to the president or his, you know, chief people? And all of that will be pretty interesting.
Yeah, it should be very interesting, particularly the part about how often did Abramoff talk to the president.
Right. Now, since I haven't seen the exact draft report, and again, it's a draft report, so they may be putting more in it by Thursday. These things tend to grow when they come before the committee.
Yeah. Okay. And what else is going on?
Okay, Supreme Court today. They came up with, a lot of people consider them boring decisions, but there was a 6-3 that essentially says you can sue for workforce discrimination, but you really can't sue to the same degree the government as you can for a private company. So, in other words, they're now going to discriminate against government workers who are discriminated against. And that's
What's the basis of that? Is that sovereign immunity?
It
seems like it would be all or nothing if you were going
to
do that.
The protection clause when they were arguing it. So I don't.
They're arguing the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment doesn't reference government. It just says no person shall be denied equal protection under the law.
I have no idea how they came up with that decision, and Jay Tamboli is going to be looking into that for me today, so I'll probably have better answers tomorrow. Of course, the newspapers will as well. Also, the president signed an executive order on Friday saying that people who do business with the Fed, subcontractors, contractors, must use a system to verify workers' eligibility to work on those government contracts.
Now, I'm not sure that's a bad thing.
No, I'm not either. There's a case that you are very familiar with, the Philip Morris case that came before the Oregon Supreme Court. And it was a case against a $79.5 million judgment that I guess the Oregon Supreme Court reinstated. Anyhow, the Supreme Court has agreed to hear that case.
Oh, interesting. Whether or not tobacco victims will have their day in court, will get their compensation?
I believe that's what it is.
Yeah.
But it is that Oregon case.
Or was it the case where they came in and spent all this money to try and influence an election? I frankly don't remember which one it was.
I think it's the right to be heard.
Yeah, okay.
And the federal whistleblower Interestingly enough, even though federal employees don't have the rights, if you're a federal whistleblower, that can be applied to subcontracts. That's what the Supreme Court found on that, subcontractors. So if it's a, you know, Section 8A or whatever subcontract which allows minorities, those people are also, the federal whistleblower statute applies to them as well as to the main contractor.
The protections apply.
Yes.
Now, what about the fact that the Bush administration has been trying to strip out protection for whistleblowers? Did they reaffirm the right of whistleblowers to have protection under the legislation?
Well, they definitely did, and they have. The Supreme Court has actually been very good on whistleblowers.
Interesting. That's great to hear. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Coming up next, Frank Gaffney, the mastermind, or one of the masterminds of our invasion of Iraq, one of the original signatories to the Center for American, American Progress? The Center for New American Century is that. And we're going to be discussing the question, should terrorists who hit us in 9/11 be given the death penalty?
Tom Hartman.
Exposing the con in conservative.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Frank Gaffney is the man. Here's the guy. He's a founding member of the Project for the New American Century. He's a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, that group back in the 70s that told us that the Soviets had these weapons of mass destruction, these submarines that were undetectable by the CIA. Oddly enough, Don Rumsfeld leading the charge on that, along with Dick Cheney, during the Ford administration, and a signatory to the Senate New American Century document, arguing that we should invade Iraq. And now we find here, post 9/11, as we begin the process down in Guantanamo Bay of trying in these, some would call them, I would call them kangaroo courts. I suspect Frank would disagree with me. These military commissions that the Supreme Court ruled unconstitutional, so the Bush administration got a law passed making them legal. We have built a death chamber in Guantanamo, and we're planning on putting some of these guys to death. And now they're saying, yes, liberate me. Give me the opportunity to be a martyr. That's where I want to go. Frank Gaffney, welcome to the program.
Oh, Tom, your welcomes are always so generous. Thank you.
Well, Frank, you and I are on absolute opposite sides of probably the vast majority of all these issues, but I really admire the fact that you, over all these years, have been largely consistent in your worldview and out there advocating for it. I mean that not in a gratuitous way. By the way, centerforsecuritypolicy.org is your website if people want to. You're the currently and most actively the founder and president of the Center for Security Policy.
Yes, I appreciate you noting that. Most of the rest of that's pretty ancient history, but that's my day job.
Yeah, and you do it well. I'm of the opinion that, first of all, we're going to have a hell of a time even giving these guys what is perceived by the rest of the world to be a fair trial. I mean, at Nuremberg, people got lawyers. They weren't tortured. Evidence was presented. A couple of them got off. The vast majority of them actually got convicted, and some of them got hung. But nobody doubted that they were fair trials. A, I don't think we're going to have fair trials in Guantanamo, but B, even if we did and even if we were to, and even if Khalid Sheikh Mohammed didn't give his confession under torture, why are you of the opinion that he should be executed rather than given life in prison, which is absolutely the thing he doesn't want?
Well, look, my feeling about it is let's see whether he is convicted. If he is convicted and it's a conviction on a capital murder charge, which is, I believe, what he's being accused of, then that would seem to me to be a perfectly inappropriate action. I must tell you, as someone who has had some exposure to this guy and his thinking and his activities, which, by the way, were only cut short by his capture. Had he been at large, you would have found more than the 3,000 Americans whose blood is on his hands currently, almost certainly murdered by him in other attacks. So preventing him from ever having that opportunity again and, you know, unburdening the taxpayer of the cost of his incarceration seemed to me to be ancillary considerations, but justice would be served, I think, by executing him.
To the best of my knowledge, there's not a federal murder statute, is there? Isn't it not the states that decide how to execute people and that murder? I remember when Jack Kennedy was shot, there was all this concern about why are they federalizing the body when there's no federal law against murder?
Well, there's abundant federal statutes now on the books with respect to terrorism.
So that has changed. Okay, thank you. I would submit to you that if we execute this guy, he is going to become a martyr all over the jihadi world, that we are giving him and them exactly what they want, once again, as we did when we went into Iraq, and that we will be harming ourselves.
Well, I disagree with you on Iraq, and I disagree with you on this. I think that we have the enemy we're confronting is one that is emboldened more by our weakness than by our decisiveness. And I think that were we to incarcerate him, it would not deny him a martyr status of some kind in the eyes of the jihadis. Who are
so you're suggesting that by not executing somebody, we're showing weakness, that the way to be strong is to kill people.
Tom, it doesn't matter what I think. It's how it's perceived by the people that you're trying to dissuade from doing more of this. And I believe it's patently clear from their writings, from their speeches, from their videotapes, from their actions, not least, that these guys interpret every act of restraint, every act of mercy, every act of accommodation by the United States, or for that matter, other Western powers, as proof positive that we will ultimately succumb to their theopolitical agenda of submission, of domination, of bringing about Sharia.
Yeah, you know, I get that. I get what you're saying. And in a way, it sounds to me like you're saying we should become like them. They're murderous and barbarous, and therefore we should become murderous and barbarous.
No,
and I just reject that. I think by killing people, we become killers in the eyes of the world and in our own eyes. And frankly, I don't want anybody's blood on my hands unless it's absolutely an act of self-defense.
You're entitled to that view, and you have a radio show with which to propagate it. I think that most Americans believe that to the extent we can sufficiently penalize acts of barbarity like that these guys are engaged in and do so on a selective basis rather than on a wholesale basis, that's both moral and just.
Frank Gaffney, are you familiar with Dr. Fadl? He was born Saeed Imam al-Sharif, the guy who started the terrorist group al-Jihad in Egypt.
I've not met the man, no, but I'm probably familiar with his type.
Yeah, this is the guy who inspired Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was his mentor. This is the guy who wrote the original book on jihad that said it is appropriate to kill civilians. It is appropriate even to kill Muslim civilians in the greater good of jihad. This is 20 years ago. He wrote the seminal book on this whole issue. And he has now come out and written a new book. And he wrote it actually at Zawahiri's request. And in this new book, he has come out and said, Muslims must stop killing. They must stop killing innocents. They must stop killing, that jihad should not involve killing. They should stop killing Christians. They should even stop killing crusaders. And he's basically taking the position that is, if the Islamic world wants to accomplish any kind of positive goal, that killing is the last thing they should do. He's becoming the Gandhi. And it's created this huge schism. Zawahiri devoted a two-hour video a couple of months ago to this. There's a whole article about this I highly recommend to you by Lawrence Wright in the current New Yorker. It's called The Rebellion Within. How Al-Qaeda itself, which is now just down to, you know, 20, 30,000 people, is fracturing. It's falling apart as a consequence of the fact that they've seen that violence doesn't work. They saw that after 9/11, the whole world looked with horror and what they had done. And the whole world is looking at us with horror. I mean, more Europeans consider us a force for evil than for good. Why should we keep on killing people when even the people in Al-Qaeda are saying we're going to stop killing people?
Well, Tom, that was a marvelous soliloquy, but it bears very little resemblance to the truth. We were not first confronted with the idea of Islamist murder and mayhem when Al-Fadl took up his pen. That's been going on for decades, if not centuries. We are not going to see it end with one guy coming to a conclusion that I would like to think a lot of people would come to, namely that this isn't good for them as human beings.
I don't think it's just a small conclusion. I think he's saying something that the vast majority of Muslims have always believed.
Well, I think that is true of the vast majority of Muslims. I just don't happen to think it reflects much of the view of the group that I call Islamofascist, of which Al-Qaeda is one example. There are lots and lots of them who believe that it is not only consistent with their moral teachings, it is their God's given duty.
So if we bomb Iran, aren't we, just as with Iraq, aren't we just handing them what they want? They get to say, see, we told you, those Christian crusaders, they're just out to get us.
Yeah.
We're the victims here.
This will shock you, Tom. I'm not one of those championing bombing Iran. I happen to think there are lots of Iranian people, in fact, the vast majority of the population of Iran, who's on our side. And we
ought
to be working with them to bring about the end of the regime that is repressing them and threatening us through means other than bombing them. But that's a subject for another day. Just to finish the thought, we're talking about a worldwide jihadist movement. If Al-Qaeda is fracturing, if Al-Qaeda is in fact on the ropes, if Al-Qaeda is in fact thinking, as you suggested it is, about giving up this mayhem and murder, I think that's because we went in, beat the hell out of them in Iraq, and I think we should acknowledge that.
Well, okay, we'll leave it at that, and I'll leave you with the last word, Frank.
Good.
I appreciate you coming on. Frank Gaffney, Center for Security Policy.org, and I would like to have a conversation with you sometime about what we should be doing in Iran. I think that would be fascinating. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Show.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Colombia. You can find out more about that at Teamster.org. And with us right now, Rich Trumka. He is the Secretary-Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, the website AFLCIO.org. Hey, Rich, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on today. Really appreciate it.
Great to have you with us on our regular labor segment here. I got this great press release. Allison Omens, I guess, is the person who wrote it. But AFL-CIO Working Families to McCain, actions speak louder than words. You guys are going to be shadowing John McCain?
Well, we have. At the last 50 places that he's been, we've had AFL-CIO people there letting everybody know his record on the economy. You know, McCain likes to paint himself as a maverick, but his record on the economy really tells a different story. He voted 95% of the time with President Bush and his corporate allies and against the interests of working families on key issues like trade and health care and overtime pay. And then he said that he's powerless to stop good jobs from leaving our country. Now, that's not the kind of bold leadership we need to turn our country around. We intend to hold him accountable.
Well, let's see. John McCain says we're going to have more wars. Sorry to inform you, we're going to have more wars. We're going to stay in Iraq for 100 years. And Bush is trying to negotiate that right now. He's holding $20 to $50 billion of Iraqi money in our banks hostage, saying that it's owed by Saddam and we're not going to give it back to them unless they sign this agreement. McCain is saying, sorry, the jobs are gone. They're not going to come back.
Right.
We're not going to have rational trade policies. We're going to have trade policies that
more
favor big multinational corporations, right, period. Frankly, Rich, I'm of the opinion that the American people are beyond this, that we're back as we were in the 30s to where the majority of Americans no longer trust corporations. Unlike in the 80s when Reagan came into office, actually public opinion polls showed that people trusted corporations over government. I think that's I know it's reversed again. And I think the result of that is going to be a resounding defeat for John McCain if we can make sure that every American knows this.
Well, that's our job. We're trying to do that. 81% of the American people say that the economy is headed in the wrong direction right now. They understand these trade deals are bad, and what's he done? He said he'd give you more of the same. He hasn't seen a single thing bad. American wages have stagnated. He doesn't have a single thing to do to solve them. Wealth inequality is the highest it's been since 1928. Not a word. He loves the current trade policy, wouldn't change a thing, has done nothing and offers nothing to solve the health care crisis, wants to privatize Social Security so his Wall Street buddies can take more money out of the pockets of the working class people. And I think he told the truth one time, though, Tom. He said, the issue of economics is something that I've really never understood as well as I should.
Yeah.
That's pretty obvious from his policies.
How do we help people cut through the fog that is John McCain? And in particular, how do we help the members of the press corps who have been seduced by this guy? I mean, he's got a very charming personality. He's been very good to the press. He learned early on how to be good to the press, how to basically smother them, overwhelm them. And, there's just been so little critical coverage over the last two decades of John McCain, when so much of it was entirely, I would say, particularly Keating Five era. But ever since then, so much of it was appropriate.
Yeah, well, we have a website called John McCain Revealed, and so you can get all the voting facts out on him. Everything. We're going to the work sites. We're doing leafleting. We're doing phone banking. We're talking worker to worker to get his record out. The fact that he votes against collective bargaining for every group out there, for teachers, for firemen, for policemen, for TSA people. The fact that he wants to give another tax break to the wealthy and he votes against the minimum wage. The fact that he loves the trade policy that we have and wouldn't change a thing. All of those things we're getting out, and we're doing it right at the grassroots level. And as soon as we get them the facts, it has a pretty astounding effect. We've moved a number of our members that had originally fallen for the hype and the soft sell of John McCain. When you show the facts, when you show he voted with Bush 95% of the time and you're going to get a third term of Bush, they start to say, we can't stand this. The country just can't take another 4 or 8 years of a Bush-like government.
Right. And that website, by the way, is over at AFLCIO.org.
That's correct.
Because I just tried to type in johnmccainrevealed.com and .org and got nothing. But if you go to AFLCIO.org, it's in the issue section, in the politics section. There's a detailed Working Families Vote 2008, John McCain Revealed, the briefing book, Economy, Good Jobs, Health Care, Trade, Workers' Rights, Retirement Security, McCain and Bush, Take Action.
All of it documented, too. Every vote that's on there, there's a reference where you can go back and check it for yourself if you doubt the site.
Yeah, okay. And so let's stop the wars. Let's stop the exporting of our jobs. Let's bring our jobs back home. Let's make them good, strong jobs. Let's give everybody the right to join a union simply by checking a card and saying, yes, I'd like to, without having to sit through hours of long indoctrination sessions by their corporations. Let's do it.
Where do I sign on? I'm ready.
There you go. Well, you're doing a great job. Rich Trumka, Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, the website AFLCIO.org. Rich, thanks so much for the great work you're doing.
Thank you, Tom. Really appreciate it. Take care,
buddy. Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls at 866-303-2270 on the topics of the day. The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Worry about tomorrow.
cry, cuss and pray, trying to matter to somebody. Four minutes past the hour. Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And Tony in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Tony, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you guys doing there?
Great.
Well, fabulous. I'm enjoying your show. Listening to you over the internet, Nova.
Mm-hmm.
The question that I'm discussing is about them. Should we go ahead and execute these folks in Guantanamo Bay?
Right.
No, I don't believe so. Let me explain why briefly. I'm online. I'm looking at Telegraph UK. They say that the greatest abnormality, however, is the 3 or 4 years that the detainees have spent in the legal netherworld of CIA prisons. One, they've been held incommunicado for 18 months. How do I know these people are actually the ones who orchestrated this? Could they be contract killers?
Well, and even if they are, do we really want to be a nation who kills people? We're
no.
the last major industrial power in the world that has the death penalty. I mean, we're here with Saudi Arabia and Yemen. I mean, and China. I mean, there's a few brutal regimes in the world that execute
right.
people, and we're one of them.
Well, you know what? I actually just left China. I was living in China for the last year, and China has 56 capital punishments. 56, okay?
Right.
The thing about it is, we have responsibility as America. We're still looked at and perceived upon as this nation that, you know, this goodwill and, you know, we still have a little bit of that. We need to try to use that, as Bush would say, our capital. We need to try to use that political capital to our best advantage. And killing these people or not, I mean, really, to be honest with you, the chickens have come home to roost. We have bombed, maimed, murdered at least a third of the globe's countries
yeah,
over the
right.
last 50
no,
years.
You're
so don't
right.
you
Reverend
think,
Wright was right,
you know,
Tony.
Yeah, don't you think it might come back?
Right.
Not to say that it's right that these people, if they did it.
No.
But the thing about it is that in essence, we are attempting to execute people for some of the same devices that our government has done.
Yeah, it's more chickens to come home and roost some more. Tony, thanks. Thank you very much for the call. Well said. Very well said. Corey in South Miami Beach, Florida, listening to Wins. Hey, Corey.
Hey, how you doing? I wanted to comment on what she just said, because I was listening to where there was a reporter that was, I guess, listening to the Sheikh Khaled guy and the other guy.
Yeah, Sheikh Khalid Mohammed.
Yeah, and then whenever they would try to say certain things, they would hit a button and they would fuzz them out.
That's right. Yeah, whenever the detainees were being asked questions where they talked about being tortured, that
right.
was not that audio was not allowed to be passed through to the reporters who were in the other room who were listening to this so-called trial. I mean, this is the Soviet Union on steroids.
But the original thing I wanted to make a comment on was the previous gentleman when you said that there was where people like previous Mujahideen and militants were turning on Al-Qaeda because they were simply just killing too many civilians.
Yep.
And it's not just that guy. It's the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yep.
It's because of, like, you know, they're just killing too many average everyday people, and it's just not cool anymore.
Well, and it's also not accomplishing their goals, and they're getting it. And it's also, you know, a fundamental violation of Islam, and they're getting that. So at every level, good point, Corey. Thank you very much. At every level, and I strongly recommend that you pick up this current copy. I'm assuming it's the current issue. I bought it in the airport on the way home from New York yesterday. So it's on the books. It was on the newsstands yesterday. Current issue of the New Yorker with this article about how the jihadist movement, at least Al-Qaeda, specifically Al-Qaeda, is fracturing. Its main thinker, its most articulate thinker, its most famous thinker, has now come out and said, this is wrong. We shouldn't be killing people. It's wrong. It's really, you know, quite remarkable. Quite remarkable. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Andy in San Bernardino, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Andy.
Hey, Tom. The reason I'm calling is when you were speaking with Ellen Ratner, she said that the Supreme Court has ruled that subcontractors to the government have a responsibility now to do a background check on their employees, and you said that's not such a bad idea. That's a horrible idea. That's a violation of the Bill of Rights. That's an illegal search and seizure. It assumes that you're a criminal before you even
can walk onto a government property. And also, in my opinion, it's just another way for them to complete the search for the data, background data, that the NSA spying program could
virtually get. Every employer of any consequence in the United States, Andy, is doing background checks on their employees right now.
Right. The government.
What's wrong with that?
Has no right to that information because, well, for one thing, they probably already have that information. But for number two, it assumes that you're suspect. As I said, it assumes that you're suspect before they even allow.
See, with regard to things like asking you for your saliva or asking you for a drug test or things like that, things that are invasive, I would agree with you. I would say that that's assuming that you've committed a crime and you're having to prove yourself as innocent.
Oh, but they do.
Yeah,
they do.
I know they do, and I think it's wrong. I believe that those things are wrong and should be illegal. But when it comes to simply asking the question, what did this person do before they came to work for us? I can tell you, as an employer and as a citizen of the United States, I don't think it's inappropriate, particularly in sensitive areas, for people to be subject to the equivalent to a background check.
Yeah, I agree in sensitive areas, but I'm a mechanic, and I've been with my employer for 30 years, but I have to go through a background check now. And as I say, one of my fellow employees agreed to this before it was required, which it now obviously will be.
Yeah.
It was 70 pages long.
Oh,
they called neighbors. They called his family. They did his driving record, his tax records, his income, his medical records.
Andy, in that case, I agree with you. I revise my position. I was assuming when Ellen said this that it was like, let's find out what jobs this guy has had before. Let's find out if he has any criminal record. If we're talking about an active background check where the FBI is going out and knocking on doors for somebody who's just getting a job, if it's not a job as a spook, for the CIA or something like that, I agree with you. I'll go along with that. Andy, thanks a lot for bringing that up and adding a level of subtlety to it. Fred in Miami, Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, Fred, what's on your mind? Hey, Fred? No Fred. Okay. Let's go to Mike in Pasadena, California. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how are you?
Just great.
What's love up? Your show.
Thank
and
you.
I will give you a quick plug. I'm in right in the middle of cracking the code, and it's wonderful. I love it.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. I wanted to go back to your segment when you were talking about corporations and businesses owning everything and controlling everything. And to me, everything tracks back down to really true campaign finance reform and who controls the purse strings.
Right.
But that's where it really seems to run down to. And I just wondered what your thoughts were. If that could really actually happen, if you really think we could really have true campaign finance reform. If that's something that's really possible.
Well, I think so. In Maine and Arizona, they've both moved a long way in that direction. There are some other states. Here in Portland, Oregon, as a municipality, we have voter-owned elections. The fact that Barack Obama and the Democratic National Party, the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, Howard Dean, have come out and said, that's it, we're not taking any money from lobbyists anymore, period. And Obama has refused to throughout this campaign. These are all things that I think they're great omens for the future. And again, I think they track back to pointing out that people don't trust corporate money anymore. People don't trust big corporations, and they get it that there are some things that we the people, a.k.a. government, do better than private corporations. The Bill Frist's daddy becoming a billionaire on the back of private, mostly county hospitals, nonprofit hospitals being bought up and flipped private and having the blood squeezed out of them and out of the people in them is, you look at it in retrospect and you say, how could we have let that happen? That's so wrong. That's so absolutely wrong. So, yeah, we need campaign finance reform in a big way. And Mike, thanks for the call and thanks for pointing it out. And in fact, if we simply said $5 a person on your tax return, just check that box. Every year, we each kick in, everybody who pays taxes, we all kick in $5. There's 100 million people who file tax returns every year who are working. I think it's 115 million people in the workforce, 118 million, something like that. So let's say 100 million people at $5 a piece. That's $500 million. Now, if you combined that with some sort of reasonable requirement, those provisions of the Fairness Doctrine and of the Telecommunications Act before Ronald Reagan gutted the former and Bill Clinton gutted the latter, those provisions that required networks and radio and television stations to at least give some airtime to candidates who are running for office in their communities. If you combine the two, we would have, or could have, a clean electoral system. I think that'd be a marvelous thing, an absolutely marvelous thing. Kevin in Greenfield, Mass. Hey, Kevin, we've got a minute before this break. What's up?
Yes, hi. It's an honor to talk to you. I just was wanted to point out that when that gentleman from the Project for the New American Century was on, the last thing he said was that he thought Al-Qaeda was weakened because we had bombed them in Iraq. And I wish you had called him on the fact that Al-Qaeda wasn't there until we destabilized the country.
Well, you're right, and we were running out of time. It was a point worth making. I did say that I disagreed with him on that position, and I said twice during the interview that I felt that our invading Iraq had given them exactly what they wanted, and it did. I mean, Osama bin Laden came right out, and he said his goals were to have oil over $100 a barrel, U.S. troops out of Saudi Arabia, and bankrupt the United States. And guess what? He's accomplished all three. George W. Bush has given Osama bin Laden everything he wanted. I mean, you know, how weird does it get? He got everything he wanted. 45 minutes past the hour. Our toll-free number, 866-303-2270. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. It's free. There's all kinds of video over there, too. And, of course, AirAmerica.com. Lots of great stuff there. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Before the hour. This, by the way, this is an extraordinary piece from today's Financial Times. The headline, Iraq denies it is to be U.S. springboard into Iran. Remember, the Iranian bank is open in downtown Iraq. Iran and Iraq are doing a lot of trade together. Nouri al-Maliki, Iraq's prime minister, tried at the weekend to allay Iranian concerns about a possible U.S.-Iraqi treaty that might provide for a long-term U.S. troop presence in Iraq. ISNA, the Iranian student news agency, quoted Nouri al-Maliki as saying, "We will not let Iraq become a base for hurting Iran's security." Tehran fears that a long-term U.S. presence in Iraq could be used as a base for military intervention in Iran. Iraqi parties across the spectrum have raised concerns about this agreement. This is this deal that Bush is trying to shove down the throats of the Iraqis, where the contractors get immunity, the soldiers get immunity, they have 50 bases or 40 bases, they can stay there for 50 years, they can do anything they want, they can arrest Iraqis, we can run our own private prisons, we basically get to run the country as our own, thank you very much, we can do anything we damn well please. And the Iraqis are saying, no, no. Right now, this multinational force is governed by a series of UN resolutions, and what the Iraqis are saying is, let's renew the UN resolutions if you want to have some forces here that are going to help us out, rather than America basically taking over and saying, you know, we now own this thing. I mean, how strange does it get, right? Anyhow, a lot of folks want to hop into the conversation here. 866-303-2270, and we've got 4 or 5 minutes left. Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Joe.
Yeah, I'm sick and tired of these idiots on TV talking about what us consumers need to be getting used to with these gas prices. Ever since the re-invasion of Iraq 5 years ago, the gas prices have tripled. I thought when we attacked Iraq back in 1991, we didn't want Saddam Hussein getting control of the oil, so he wouldn't be jacking up the
well,
gas.
Well, that was the point that Bill O'Reilly and Rupert Murdoch made. They said that if we simply invaded Iraq, that oil would be $20 a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see it happening. I'm, you know, where is it, Rupert?
Of course not.
I don't see it happening. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Addison in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Addison.
Hi, how are you?
Just great.
Hey, just real quick, I guess I was calling because I kind of had a little bit of a disagreement or, I don't know, another opinion on this whole SUV and gas prices.
Right.
doesn't make any sense. Now, I've been on hold for a while, but a while earlier, you had mentioned, you know, all these people are now stuck with these SUVs, and they're going to be in debt because they're not going to be able to resell them at the value. And
well, my main point is that when you leave things up to the market, that the market corrects damages. In other words, if somebody is selling, you know, if you say, okay, we're not going to have a U.S. Department of Agriculture anymore, which is something that Ron Paul would do. He'd do away with all regulatory agencies and all inspection agencies. No more Department of Agriculture, no more Food Inspection Service. So, you know, a couple thousand people die of salmonella. At that point, the market is going to cause those people to lose their businesses, and companies that sell salmonella-free lettuce are going to find a whole new marketplace. But you've still got a bunch of dead people. The market only corrects harms. It takes government to prevent harms. That's the prevention principle, essentially, you know, that is used in Europe. That was my point. And my point was that if we had seen, and we did see this coming at the level of government, and we tried to do something, but the conservatives stopped us. If we had said 30 years ago, if we had stuck with Jimmy Carter's position that vehicles had to be more fuel efficient, then people wouldn't be driving these tanks now as it is. They wouldn't have listened to Rush Limbaugh, who said, oh, you'll be much safer, you know, and isn't it macho and whatnot.
I agree, but I guess my point is that you can't just blame the system. I mean, people, if you haven't been paying attention as an individual, you have to know that gas is not it's not an infinite product. And at some point, you know, we've been very spoiled with low gas prices. And in my opinion, it's about high time we started paying what these high prices should be.
Yeah.
And if you were dumb enough to not see an increase in gas over the period of years, especially since Bush, a very big oil-loving guy, has been in office, and you still went out there and still bought an SUV, then I'm sorry, but I don't think that's due to the market. I mean,
yeah.
Sometimes people have to take
dumb
responsibility for their actions. I'm a pretty progressive person, but I just yelled at my brother about this for buying a truck, and now he's complaining he can't afford it.
Right.
Come on.
Yeah, well, you know,
you know,
but see, you're suggesting that back, you know, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, well, when Bush came into office and gas was $1.20 a gallon, everybody should have known that it was going to go up to $4 a gallon and made purchasing decisions accordingly. And I think a lot of people, particularly families with children, bought larger vehicles thinking that they were actually buying an insurance policy, that they were buying safety for their family. Turns out that it wasn't true then. It's not true now.
Yeah.
But
the Subaru,
you know,
Outback is really a safety car, smaller.
Oh, there's a lot of very safe cars. Yeah.
I mean, come on. It doesn't take much to research and find that stuff out. I mean,
it was conventional wisdom. Addison, I get your point. And at a certain level, I don't disagree with you. I also don't think we should be blaming the victims. Intellect in Miami, Florida. We got about a half a minute before we got to wrap up the show today. What's up?
Well, Tom, I wanted to talk about the race issue. Basically, the point I wanted to make really quick was that I agree it's about poverty to a degree, but what it's mainly about is self-segregation of peoples. Because even with black people who self-segregate themselves have this tendency to believe that white people won't let them advance in the culture, so why should they bother trying to go to school and get a good job and whatnot?
Yeah, that's the stuff, good point, Intellect, and that's the stuff we've got to break through. I mean, at a certain level, there's that human nature of this is our group, that's their group. It's the basis of nationalism, it's the basis of family. It can be a healthy impulse or it can be a toxic one. Our job is to help make it a healthy one. Tomorrow, John Bolton, former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., is going to be here. With the U.S. and Israel both ramping up rhetoric, we're going to ask him, is the administration planning to attack Iran? And David Sirota is dropping by on his new book, Uprising. Yes, we're taking our country back, a National Geographic with a Higgins alert. It's going to be great. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there. Get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.
That's T-H-O-M Hartman with two N's, radio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.